the president is pushing us down this road, and if in particular, after having sought foreign assistance and welcomed foreign assistance in the last presidential campaign as a candidate, he is now doing the same thing again, but now using the power of the presidency, then he may force us to go down this road. I have spoken with a number of my colleagues over the last week, and this seems different in kind, and we may very well have crossed the Rubicon here.
That was House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff. Remember him? On CNN's State of the Union Sunday, talking about the possibilities of impeachment. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable of the Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, joined by my co-workers, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy Equinox, gang.
Howdy.
What is the Equinox?
Happy Monday.
What is the Equinox?
Equinox, there's a fall Equinox and a spring Equinox, and that is the moment in which the sun is directly over the equator or something like that. It's a midway.
It's also a high-end gym chain.
Is this the vernal Equinox
that
or the other one?
Involved in some political...
The vernal one is spring.
Okay, so then what is this one?
This is the Vermin Supreme Equinox.
This is the one that is sponsored by Trump or is hosting, this Equinox is hosting a Trump fundraiser?
Yeah, today raised $1 million for Donald Trump in the Hamptons, so we got to boycott it.
We are going to unravel or attempt to this latest ball of Slavo confusion in a bit. But first, are you looking for other great podcasts? Then check out the new documentary-style podcast series by our friends over at the Institute for Justice called Bound by Oath. It's an in-depth look at the history of the United States Constitution, featuring interviews with historians, legal experts, and the real people involved in cases both bygone and ripped out of the headlines. That's Bound by Oath, Institute for Justice, available wherever you can find tasty podcasts. Now, back to ours. So, deep breath, everyone. Here is what we currently know. On July 25th, President Donald Trump called Ukraine's new president, Volodymyr Zelensky, and during the conversation, asked Zelensky to investigate the man who has been dominating polls in the contest to be Trump's opponent in the 2020 presidential race, Joe Biden. The administration a couple of weeks earlier unexpectedly delayed a delivery of promised aid to Ukraine. Trump claims these issues are unrelated, although he could totally do it if he wants to. His critics are invoking the specter of a president withholding money in order to pressure a government to dig up dirt on a potential political adversary. What about Biden in this case? Well, as vice president, he managed the Obama administration's Ukraine portfolio, even while his own son, Hunter, was director of a large oligarchian Ukrainian natural gas something or other called Burisma Holdings. What's more, Hunter Biden, who was making $50,000 a month at this job, and Burisma were targets of a corruption probe under a previous Ukrainian government. And as Vice President Biden threatened to withhold U.S. loan guarantees if the lead prosecutor on that probe didn't either step down or get fired. Biden says that those issues were unrelated, and it's worth pointing out that pretty much everybody in both the United States and the world thought that that particular prosecutor, like so many other people in the Ukrainian government now and then, was corrupt as hell. So why do we know about this July 25th phone call? Because of an unidentified whistleblower inside the intelligence bureaucracy who used a whistleblower law. We don't know anything about his or her motivation or the information and how they found it, this kind of stuff. An inspector general took a look at this and thought it was serious enough to forward it along and report it to the relevant congressional intelligence committees. The administration's acting director of national intelligence, after conferring with the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, declined to pursue the complaint further, and now House Democrats are demanding to see the whistleblower complaint in the flesh or in their hands or whatever. The administration is declining, and as of this fine Monday equinoxical morning, all of the newspapers are talking about a growing chorus for impeachment. And I'm sorry for the length of that, but I think that it's important sometimes. Catherine! It is tempting at moments like this to skip over, you know, examination of how the president acted like a jackass and instead focus on the ridiculous overreach by the anti-Trump people. But my God, the ridiculous overreach by the anti-Trump people. You had Bill Weld this morning on MSNBC pointing out that this is treason, saying that this is treason, and pointing out that treason is punishable by execution. Mm. So my question to you, O Editrix, is have we learned nothing over these past 2 years? And or is me asking the question that way making me guilty of whataboutism and I'm the problem in the first place?
I was really hoping you were going to say that the question that this raises is what method of execution should Trump experience?
Damn it, you're not wrong. So start with the next question, Catherine, and work your way towards mine.
I was also going to say it's a fine start to a Monday morning to go straight to the execution talk. I mean, you know, impeachment is for wimps. Yeah. Let's get real, as I suppose Bill Weld is doing. So I think that there are a bunch of things going on here. The first, though, is to say if this account is true, it is indeed bad news. This is not a thing a president should be doing. It has echoes of allegations from the 2016 campaign and collusion with foreign leaders to acquire dirt on Democratic opponents, which I think makes it more compelling and easy to digest for the American public, which is at this point utterly worn down by the weekly drip of vague malfeasance by the president. Our very own staffers here at Reason sometimes have a little meme that goes around in our Slack, which is the, in any other administration, story X of corruption would be a full week of news coverage wall to wall. In this administration, we literally don't have time to cover it because a bigger story happened the morning before it and the evening after it. This is a true and real thing that people who are looking to normalize or excuse Trump's behavior would not do well to ignore. At the same time, I want to remind everyone that several weeks ago in July-ish, one of my what are you consuming recommendations was the New Yorker's profile of Hunter Biden, which was headlined, "Will Hunter Biden cost his father the presidency?" or something similar. Hunter Biden might cost his father the presidency, but at this point, I guess it also looks like maybe he'll win his father the presidency, weirdly, if this all ricochets back on Trump. So in conclusion, I don't know what's going on anymore and everything is bad.
Let's pick up the Hunter Biden part of that, because I'm sort of interested as a symbol, not as like, hey, whatever he did is equivalent to whatever Trump did. They're just their own categories. But there was a line, Peter, in a New York Times kind of explainer bit over the weekend. And the explainer was sort of like to try to say that Joe Biden is not really kind of in trouble and, you know, people are going too far. But here's a little mini paragraph. When Hunter Biden joined the board of Burisma, he had no experience in Ukraine. He has a professional history, including a number of roles that intersected with his father's political career. When his father represented Delaware in the Senate, Hunter Biden worked with a credit card issuer in the state. He also worked at the Commerce Department under President Bill Clinton and as a lobbyist on behalf of various universities, associations, and companies. Ain't that the swamp, damn it, Peter, at long last? It's like it's all probably legal, but it happens all the time. It seems like family members of important people, whether they're governors or presidents or vice presidents or whatever, just find themselves magically pulling down 50 G's a month for doing jack all.
It's a good living if you can get it. No, it's all the swamp. I mean, there's crocodiles and there's like swamp things, like so many swamp things. And if you've read the Alan Moore Swamp Thing run, which is great, and I recommend it to everybody. That's not my recommendation, by the way. You realize like that it all like connects back to like a history of like multiple swamp things who live in the trees forever. That's basically Washington, D.C. in 2019, is that there's no, everything's connected. It's all sort of deeply rooted, all under the surface. You can't really see it. And there's no getting rid of it or stopping it. And no real tracing a single point of origin. Everyone is caught up in this. And so that includes Donald Trump and his campaign manager, Paul Manafort, who was just clearly working for a bunch of oligarchical types and taking a lot of money and owed a lot of money. That includes Biden's son. And I think it's a thing that it's sort of hard to figure out how you end up with a politics that doesn't have this. And you see a lot of politicians running against, well, you know, I'm an outsider. I'm not from I'm someone who it doesn't sort of exist in the beltway. The mise en scene, right? Like this is not my world. And then inevitably they show up and they're part of it, or they already were part of it, because that's what politics is.
That's depressing. Nick, speaking of depressing, I think, so this story broke last Wednesday, I think was the first article. And by Friday, it was really cooking with the old gas because the Wall Street Journal got confirmation of a phone call. And I had on the MSNBC during lunch, as I might do sometimes. And like, it was amazing to me. I was like, you know, the most grave constitutional crisis so far of the Trump presidency. It was as if there was this wish fulfillment machine that was just sort of idling on the side of the road. And then it's like, oh, here it comes. And it got caught up. You were sharing on Slack a piece by New York Times columnist David Leonhardt today, titled Just the Facts, that I'm seeing get shared all around Twitter. Talk a little bit about that and its kind of role in the wish fulfillment machine.
I think, you know, one of the ways to think about Democrats or anti-Trump people right now is they're a lot like Dr. Bellows from I Dream of Jeannie, where every episode, they know that they have, you know, Major Nelson, Larry Hagman's character, who is secretly housing the ultimate alien, right? Like, they have him dead to rights. Dr. Bellows is going to drop the bomb on Major Nelson, and he's going to be drummed out of service, et cetera. And then, like, in the last moment, something happens, and Jeannie, you know, works her magic, and Dr. Bellows is left being a fool. That's where the Democrats are, and that's where anti-Trump people are. And that's where David Leonhardt is, where he's just saying sometimes it's worth stepping back to look at the full picture.
Well, but there's also, I mean, a sort of a pinky in the brain aspect here,
yeah,
right?
What are we going to do? Yeah.
It's Monday. What are we going to do? The same thing
we're
do every
take
Monday.
Over the world.
Try to impeach the president.
Yeah. No, and it's one of the things that is odd to me, you know, and the Leonhardt piece is great because, it, you know, the top of that column is pretty good. It's like he's pressured a foreign leader to interfere in the 2020 American presidential election. That is the charge against Trump. It is not clear that it's true because, it, you know, Trump has denied that, and we don't know what was in that particular phone call. I don't know if...
Well, he's admitted to asking the guy to investigate Biden.
But,
which would obviously have an impact on the
election. No, but it's also that it's to talk about the corruption in Ukraine. He's saying that, like, withholding aid, which is since Ukraine has gotten, and in fact, the U.S. has been really helpful to Ukraine since Trump took office, regardless of his, you know, comments towards Russia or towards Putin in particular. But, you know, is that impeachable? But then Leonhardt ends, like, towards the end, he's like, you know, in 2016, Trump referred to the country as a hellhole. Like, to America as a hellhole. And that is somehow...
It's not even by the time you get to the end. Like, the seventh thing on the list is he genuflects to murderous dictators.
So,
and I think it's telling that that one and the one after it, which is he has alienated America's closest allies, don't have links. Like, the idea is, like, this is facts. Here are links to all these facts.
He does genuflect to murderous dictators.
So what? Jimmy Carter.
And a matter of opinion, for sure. You could have just left it out. You didn't need it. This list is bad already.
I mean, Jimmy Carter's Wall of Fame and his, you know, massive presidential library and everything is like French kissing Gaddafi and, you know, other people who are murderous dictators. It's like all of this stuff is like, we're supposed to say that Trump is uniquely evil and rotten and hence must be impeached, or that's a stretch, must be voted out. That's plausible. You know, this replay and this reflexive action on the part of people instead of actually talking about policies, I don't think it's helping. It's not helping the Democrats, and it's not going to conjure up an impeachment trial against Trump. It's bizarre to me. And one of the things, I cannot in any circumstance see myself voting for Donald Trump. I can see myself breathing a sigh of relief that he gets reelected over the possible alternatives. Those are very different things. But one of the things that I think he is clarifying is that, you know, he is showing the way that power is used in a way that is clumsy and gross and vulgar and disturbing and not that different from the way it was before him and the way it will be done after him. And I think we need to use this as a moment where we actually do say politics should not, you know, we shouldn't put up, if we just say that, well, this is what happens, political power can only be wielded in a self-interested way. I mean, like fucking Hunter Biden, he should be working a minimum wage job at a fucking Burger King. And instead he's overseeing a $1 billion hedge fund and stuff like that. You know, we need to take this as a moment to get serious about restraining power and restraining the power of the federal government and government at every other level.
Yeah, I want to talk about that conversation for a minute, the alleged conversation that Trump had, because it actually reminded me of way back during the election when Ted Cruz, I think it was, accused Donald Trump of having New York values. Do you remember that? And there was this whole back and forth.
That was the end of Ted Cruz.
What does that even mean? And that was the end of Ted Cruz. And it was just this whole kerfuffle. But, you know, I do find myself thinking, even though I share with much of the American public an antipathy for kind of DC insiders and operators and the status quo generally, I can't help but think that type of conversation, when you are not bound by the strictures of government and being the president of the United States, is a pretty normal conversation, right? Like, you call a guy who you're working with on something and, you know, he wants something from you and you just say like, hey, what have you got for me? That's like a normal way humans behave. Now, in this case, it is not an appropriate way, just to be clear. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, we have very, very clear rules about what presidents can and cannot do in these circumstances and should and shouldn't do, expectations about what they should and shouldn't do. But it's just, in some ways, this just feels like more of incompetence than anything else. It just feels like he didn't listen when people told him how things are supposed to be done. And I wonder what y'all think about that. Like, it's a pretty normal thing, what he did. It's just so happens to be against a variety of codes of behavior in Washington, D.C.
I think one possible answer to that is that Trump is in some ways leaning into this because he wants to be impeached. And I'm going to exaggerate this just a little bit. I don't know if you could just hear my eyes roll over the mic just now.
I think
that Trump would much rather have a 2020 race that revolves entirely around the impeachment question, that he can then flip back onto Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, that he can talk about collusion, no collusion, than on practically anything else. And I also think that Nancy Pelosi has increasingly, has since Democrats took the House back, has signaled and tried to signal to her base that she believes that that is correct, that she also thinks that it would be bad for Democrats to run the next year's election campaign mostly on impeachment. Because if an impeachment proceeding, a meaningful one, really happens in the House and it goes through and it gets into the Senate and Mitch McConnell has to kind of awkwardly duck all of these questions about Trump's bad behavior, then it will absolutely consume all of the discussion. And that's, I think, what Trump wants, is for there not to be another discussion, just for there to be this kind of complicated, kind of vague thing in which Democrats say, not entirely wrongly, hey, man, this seems like maybe it's actual collusion when you call the leader of a foreign government and ask them to investigate their rival. And Trump says, but what about Hunter Biden? Yeah. And also, all I was doing was, and then there's the all these details about Russian oligarchs and no one can remember their names. And we get lost in, you know, some sort of morass and I'm start making Swamp Thing references. And it just becomes a total mess that no one can follow. And we're not talking about policy. And so, Nick, I think, you know, part of what I would respond to your argument about we need to get away from this conversation, we need to start talking about policy and stuff that matters, is that it's very difficult to do with Donald Trump in the White House because Trump doesn't want to talk about those
things.
And Trump goes out of his way to avoid letting people have substantive discussions about policy. And Democrats respond accordingly. I don't think they respond well to this.
Yeah.
But it's virtually impossible to imagine a somewhat normal, somewhat rational political policy discussion about America's future happening while Trump is in office.
I don't disagree with you, but I think that's a fundamental flaw of, you know, the Democratic response to this. If they're serious about advancing a policy agenda, they are spending all of their time talking about Trump's, you know, personal failings and process failings. And I do think that's important. You know, one of the things to say to Catherine's point, you know, when Trump says certain things because he doesn't know better or he doesn't care about the rules, think about it like a checklist where you know, certain types of protocols are supposed to be in place because they make sure that you are not, in rushing to a conclusion that everybody agrees with, you're not missing various steps that are actually important. And that is why you vet candidates. That is why you do actual cost-benefit analysis on proposed legislation and things like that. And I do think there is a serious problem with the way that Trump, you know, just cuts corners because he knows what result he wants. And it's, come on, we all know that you can fake all of this stuff. We saw that with Obamacare and the Congressional Budget Office becoming, you know, essentially, or the OMB or whatever agency, like you can con them into jiggering the result to the way that you want it. And that's actually where I've been thinking a lot about Justin Amash, who, you know, turned away from the Republican Party and became an independent. And part of that, lately, he's been talking about how being a good Speaker of the House is antithetical to being a party leader, that these two jobs are absolutely at odds with one another because the Speaker of the House is there to protect the integrity of the House of Representatives, not, you know, the partisan agenda of a particular party. That kind of thinking is really out of fashion, but reviving an interest and an embrace in that kind of mentality is actually really important. And where you say, when you're starting a legislative process or a diplomatic process or whatever, you would, you know, you agree that you were going to follow certain protocols because those things turn up regularly, turn up issues or problems that otherwise just kind of get glossed over in a cynicism of saying, well, we all are liars, we're all cheaters, and we're all going to do, you know, we're going to rush to the conclusion that we want anyway. And I think part of what Democrats or anti-Trump people are having difficulty kind of stomaching is that he has actually revealed a lot of ugly behavior on the part of his opponents. And, like, you know, Joe Biden has a lot to answer for, and the Hunter Biden question is part of that. Elizabeth Warren,
he's also revealed an awful lot of ugly behavior on the part of Republicans.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
People who back
yeah,
him.
No, and I agree. And this, you know, this is part of him as, you know, in the Eugene O'Neill play, The Iceman Cometh, there's a character who comes into a bar once a year, and he forces everybody to, like, kind of face up to the fact that they're barflies and they're never going to do anything in their lives. And he's revealed, spoiler alert, he's revealed as, like, a psychopathic killer at the end. And Trump is kind of like that. He's the hickey character in The Iceman Cometh in American politics, where he is, you know, he is destroying all of the illusions that we have about ourselves and our process. And then the question is, what do you do when he exits stage right? Because we're still left with stuff. And I don't want to live in a world, I don't think that politics, and I don't think the federal government has to be so grossly kind of partisan or weaponized or low ideal. I think there are ways to kind of rise above that. And first and foremost is the idea of limiting the amount of power so that the stakes are lower. Because when the stakes are lower, then people are more likely, I think, to follow the rules, especially if they think the rules might mean that they lose in a particular case.
I'm just excited for a full year of podcasts about the impeachment question and whether Hunter Biden's deals with Ukraine really were.
Well, he's got his China problem.
Trump is going to say.
He's got his China problem as well. And then you're left with Joe Biden. You know, I mean, Joe Biden is a joke. And it's taken, you know, we went into this weird relapse where under Obama, you know, except for the beginning of the campaign, you know, we forgot that Joe Biden is one of America's great, you know, national disgraces and jokes. And we've, you know, we're already forgotten about Corn Pop. It's been a week and we're not even talking about Corn Pop or Crazy Joe. It's not Sleepy Joe. He's Crazy Joe.
Corn Pop was the truth.
We are going to learn so much about the Ukrainian utility system.
That's great.
And it's like, I'm very excited.
I'm still waiting for the floor plan.
It's a little surprising that we don't already have, like, the Ukrainian utility expert Twitter, which surely is gathering steam.
It is.
Tom Nichols.
I want the floor plan of the U.S. mission in Benghazi. You know, that hasn't been made public yet. So, you know, back of the line.
I mean, it is an interesting point, though, what you're saying of you know, the always, you know, always an eternal libertarian fallback of, like, well, let's imagine how this plays out in a world where the powerful have less to work with. Right. And I think, you know, in this case, clearly the thing that enables this entire back and forth is the $250 million in military aid. Right. Which the president has a huge amount of discretion over, and which is to the Ukraine, if not to the United States anymore, quite a lot of money and support. And I think, you know, one hates to be kind of a broken record, but I mean,
$250 million doesn't even pay for full production and marketing costs.
Oh God, you know, Hunter Biden's Coke bill is $250 million a year.
Right. And so the idea, and I actually feel this over and over, that like the cost of quote unquote buying a politician always strikes me as low given the potential gains. And apparently the cost of buying a country is actually pretty cheap too here, again, given the potential gains, which is more or less control over this country. And so, you know, I think, again, it's just an argument for like, don't have hundreds of millions of dollars laying around for the president to hand out at his discretion. Don't have an expectation in the world that that money is coming. Don't have a presidency where the stakes are so high for possessing it that people will cross these lines.
I would also add to that, though, because, and, you know, in this, I don't know where this leads ultimately, but, you know, if we think about Trump more as the effect rather than the cause of this, don't have a Senate majority leader like Harry Reid, who is so transparently partisan when he's pretending to deal on principle about like, oh, well, we're going to get rid
of. Do you mean Mitch McConnell?
Well, no, no.
Or do you mean Harry Reid?
I mean Harry Reid.
The fact that you're not sure answers the question.
No, but Harry Reid and talking about, you know, the filibuster when it came to judicial appointees, et cetera. And McConnell is the same way, where you have these people who are, you know, one minute they are saying, this is, you know, I, you know, we have to wake up Jefferson in his grave and Madison and like, you know, we're fucking dealing with bedrock principle here and we're on this side of the issue. And then like 2 minutes later, they're on exactly the other side of the issue and they're just lying sacks of shit. And of course, people get cynical and people tune out. And it's like, it doesn't have to be that way. You could actually have politicians who are willing to say in a way that is not transparently, you know, transactional to say, no, you know what, there are certain principles that are a problem. I mean, like, look at Mitt Romney, the 2008 or whatever it was, 2012 Republican nominee. What did he say about if Trump, you know, if the charges against Trump are true? What was his phrase of art? It was something like, oh, that would be deeply troubling or, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck does that mean? You know, so what are you going to do?
Maybe it means it would be deeply troubling. Right. Peter, before we close
out. So he's not willing to say that's an impeachable offense or not.
Right. But you know what? I find a little bit of that like kind of relieving in the sense of everyone as part of the wish fulfillment machine. They want to go from zero to impeachment always. Always, like they want to get to the conclusion, which is I'm using the club and I'm beating the head of this thing that I don't
Matt,
like.
You were brilliant in 2012, which seems like 1,000 years ago, and I'm not even sure that's the right year for Mitt Romney. But Mitt Romney said he was going to cut government, and then you kept pointing out like he wouldn't actually name a single fucking thing that he would cut, and that is the problem. That is the problem.
Not even that, but he based, and this is not me, it's a Suderman, but he based his one lesson that he had learned in life, that he made the mistake when he lost to whoever the hell in the 90s, that he had mentioned one thing that should be cut. And so I'll never do that again. Yes, he's absolutely, totally a part of the problem. But one thing I want, Peter, you to grapple with before we exit this topic, Nick was talking about Justin Amash and a kind of a more principled look at different things. Amash, of course, is famous for being the only Republican, as long as that lasted, to favor impeachment. He makes the argument that if you were taking your constitutional duty seriously, that there's enough in the second Mueller report or part two of the Mueller report to do this. This was counteracted in a way that I found pretty interesting over the weekend by our pal Jen, the libertarian, Jennifer Monroe, who pointed out, hey, look, the Amash example, Nancy Pelosi is well aware of what happens. The one Republican who did this thing in the House, even not even in the Senate, immediately got drummed out of his own party by his own former, you know, cellmates in the House Freedom Caucus, which he co-founded. And he had to kind of amoosh from the party. Meanwhile, everybody else is retiring or losing. There was a Washington Post fascinating over the weekend saying that 2 out of 5 people who were Republican Congress critters at during Trump's inauguration are either retiring or are already gone, which is kind of an amazing thing. So you have you're caught between these two things. Principle might suggest, depending on how you read various things, that you should. This is the moment that you launch impeachment proceedings. However, pragmatism about the world in front of us is that, Hell no. You're never going to get a single Republican vote in the Senate, maybe one. So stop it and win the election if that's what you need to do. What say you, Peter Sutter?
If I wanted to make the case for impeachment from a political perspective, the case would be this. You impeach Trump in the House, where you have a Democratic majority that you could probably get to vote for impeachment. Nancy Pelosi doesn't seem to want to, but there's probably enough votes to do it there. And then you push that up to the Senate. And what happens in the Senate is, as you said, Republicans don't impeach Trump. That, I think, is a guaranteed outcome that they do not do it. However, what they end up having to do is excuse all of Trump's bad behavior, and it makes them look bad in the process. I'm not saying I agree with this strategy. I'm saying that if you wanted to think of a strategy, that would be it. I think that that is a long shot. It could work, maybe, but it's a long shot. And making Mitch McConnell will find ways to avoid the hardest votes and to protect his members. And it's also just the case that the core of Trump's base doesn't care that much. Now, there are swing voters and they do care, and they care a lot about stuff like the sort of the sense that Washington is ethical, is kind of clean, is working in their interests. And this would really present a case that Donald Trump is himself a dirty politician, just like all of the rest of them, who doesn't have your interests in mind. So I guess I don't know exactly how that would come out, but I also don't think it's anything like a sure shot. I think Mitch McConnell is not always a great strategist, but an incredibly savvy tactician. He knows the political playbook, how to both manage his members, manage the rules of the Senate, and manage national politics better than virtually anybody. And if there's somebody who can get through that relatively unscathed and get Republicans through that relatively unscathed, it's probably Mitch McConnell. That said, he's also not a miracle worker. He does play within limits and rules, so it's not a total impossibility. There, that's my hedgy answer is, I guess it could work.
I just want to remind us all by reading aloud the specific Trump's specific response to reporters about this, just if for no other reason than a study in like the Trumpian word salad approach. The conversation I had was largely congratulatory, with largely corruption. All of the corruption taking place, and largely the fact that we didn't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine.
Largely.
I totally agree with what he just said.
Yeah.
Because
I largely think that
I mean,
tweet
this is why,
is...
like, when you, it wasn't a tweet, this was him speaking,
oh, right.
But like, you couldn't even tell. I mean, this is why when you read the New York Times accounts, for instance, of like, has the president corroborated the allegation? Like, has he admitted that he talked to someone in the Ukraine about Biden and his son? Yeah, kind of, or maybe not at all.
So Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, very clearly admitted it, like 10 seconds after denying it. But
sure.
He was pressed by Chris Cuomo on CNN, and basically got to a point where he said, "Of course, I ordered the code red."
But I wanna remind everyone that like these are the texts that we will be dealing with for the next year, if in fact this is what we end up talking about.
I also think that's a classic case of where, okay, so because it's Trump, we're going with literal transcriptions of his phrases in a way that, like, we clean it up for other presidents, even somebody like George W. Bush, who, of course, and his father, who were considered laugh riots because they didn't speak such good English. You know, this is...
I was actually reading the literal transcript, just to be clear, like, that wasn't
someone who quoted. I get that. And what I'm saying is that the literal transcript is being published because that's a way of attacking Trump. And it's a break with... typically what happens is that stuff gets paraphrased and it's made sense. Everybody knows what Trump is saying and what he's talking about, what he's getting at.
Literally don't. I really don't. Nick, I disagree. I disagree with you.
You know, this is where it's like, oh my God, this
disagree.
Is all like, you know, he doesn't speak in proper English. You know, he's lazy.
So many
he's retarded.
Of
he's
Joe
demented.
Biden. How many transcripts did we see of Joe Biden's word salads from the last
the record,
debate?
Yeah. The record player to teach the poor. How to have brains.
You're seeing that now? Where's that coming from?
If a politician word salads, it's not because suddenly people recognize that Trump is the special Satan.
I think that's the Rubicon that's been crossed. Where did we learn about the corn pop speech, which was like a couple of years old? It was from a right winger who like found it and put it out there. And it's fighting fire with fire.
That's actually
I genuinely believe Trump speaks, he purposefully speaks in elliptical and halting ways because it insulates him from getting pinned down on any specific claim. I genuinely believe that Trump is speaking differently than presidents before him in many cases in a way that is instrumental and, if not purposeful on a rational level, instinctive and useful to him.
I would agree with instinctive and useful. I would very much disagree with purposeful.
I think he walks up to sentences, feels them coming out of his face, and just stops and starts over in ways that previous presidents, I mean, certainly that Obama did not routinely. He was a very clean speaker, cleaner than me.
If you transcribed Obama speeches, there would be the ums and the uhs, and it would be like listening to a 15-year-old Valley girl.
A bunch of ums is very different than what I just read.
What I'm saying is that if you stretch it out, it becomes impossible to listen to Obama. If you're listening for the ums and the ahs and the pauses and the mispronunciations of foreign names,
this feels like a real subtweet to our podcast producers, by the way. Shout out to Ian and Regan, who are going to clean this up.
All I'm saying is that Trump is being treated differently by the press than previous presidents. He is being treated more caustically.
Well, he
should be. That's a different question. All I'm saying is that we're constantly saying, because even the story of like the Republican Party canceling primaries, you know, because Trump is somehow uniquely evil. It's like, yeah, except that that happened in 2004, you know, when you have an incumbent president and no real challengers, like a bunch of states say, fuck it, we're canceling our primaries. But it's everything is held up again and again as Trump is uniquely bad.
Nick, you have to be smart about this. That's not smart. Right. The Trump campaign, unlike the George W. Bush campaign, is preemptively this year in what would have been 2003, pressuring state parties to cancel their primaries. This was not something that was happening in 2004 and 2003 with George W. Bush. It wasn't. The analog is George H.W. Bush attempting and doing this successfully in 1991 against Pat Buchanan in Iowa and South Dakota. And that actually led to part of the backlash that Pat Buchanan usurped. There is a category difference. The fact that some of the primaries are always canceled, that's true of incumbent presidents. Usually the mechanism for that is the state party, the year of, not the year before, notices that no one qualified for the ballot. And that's when they cancel. There's a difference. There is a difference, yes, between the way that Donald Trump talks, the way Barack Obama talks. You'd have to be crazy not to note the difference. The first thing I wrote about Donald Trump, and sadly it was not the last, was when he spoke at Freedom Fest. And it's a column that I should be widely panned for on a daily basis, because somewhere at the bottom, I said something along the lines, I can't imagine people voting for this guy based on this. And what I said, like, his enemy is the full transcript, because he doesn't hold a thought in a paragraph. It's unique. It's not like, my God, you know, I hate this guy so much, I'm going to use my devious transcript thing. No, it's like you sit and watch him for a long time and you say, Jesus Christ, what is this? Or at least how I did it at the time. It doesn't mean that I was applying a new standard. I've been using long quotes on people for a long time because I think it reflects the way that they think. So, I mean, there's a smart way of noticing double standards here, and there's a dumb way. And it's dumb to say that suddenly the American press discovered the transcript only because they uniquely hate Donald Trump. Yes, they uniquely hate him. Yes, I wish they would treat all presidents with as much hostility, but I'm not going to necessarily recoil from, you know, having one president at least issued under scrutiny. I just wish that it would happen to President Elizabeth Warren, who Peterman's going to be working for as the Health and Human Secretary or Health and Human Services Secretary. Let's shift gears.
Peter Suderman, Human Secretary.
Human Secretary.
As opposed to robot secretary.
Maybe a category error in my situation.
So I had a big windup for this, but basically Bernie Sanders, national rent control. Catherine?
Oh my God, what a terrible plan. Y'all, I started reading this thing and I had to take a break and take a deep breath before I could finish reading it because it is such a bad plan. There are infinity problems with this plan. The first is just that rent control is a bad idea. When even Paul Krugman is out there in the past saying, economists broadly agree that rent control does not increase the quality or quantity of housing. You really have something going for you. And yet this is some classic Bernie, right? He's like, you know what? I'm more socialist. I am more interventionist. I am more anti-market than all of my compadres out here in the field. And I'm going to make sure you know it. Just like a couple of details about the Sanders plan. It's a 3% cap on rent increases or 1.5 times the consumer price index, whichever is higher. That alone creates a bunch of weird problems, since if the consumer price index rises rapidly, that ratio quickly becomes pretty striking and could be out of whack. This is very different than the way that rent control works in the cities where it still exists, which typically are some percentage on top of the increases in the consumer price index rather than a percentage of. But all of this is basically just by way of saying there's a reason that after World War II, we decontrolled housing in this country. It's because we needed more housing. We needed better housing. And rent control produces the opposite of that. The defense of the Sanders plan is that it will be good for people who currently rent. That is probably true. But people who currently rent, even they will suffer because they will be incentivized not to move when moving would make sense. And they will also squat in apartments, in housing that is in demand by other people. They will essentially be inefficiently occupying apartments in places where housing will become scarce. Also, we're going to see a lot more non-housing type development. People will wind up doing subleases and Airbnb on existing properties, which then we will create a whole vast web of regulations to fight that. People will convert housing to office space, thus reducing the supply of housing rather than increasing it. It is a terrible idea. Rent control is a terrible idea. It has failed persistently, consistently. Everywhere that it has tried to impose it nationwide would be a disaster. Oh my God, Bernie, stop.
Peter, it's not just Bernie. And it's not just nationally. Oregon earlier this year passed state rent control. Minneapolis last week or the other week passed a thing saying that you can't have a landlord screening tenants for stuff like credit scores or eviction histories, among other things. Beto O'Rourke said a couple of weeks back that being able to live within 1 hour commute of where you work is a right. And so the federal government has a needs to get in there and do things.
I must have missed that constitutional amendment.
It's all of which is to say, if and when you ever hear Democrats describe themselves as a party of science, doesn't rent control, does just housing policy itself?
They don't mean the dismal science, not that one.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, it's not a real science. We know. We all know that, right? Like, there's no. It's not real science. I would actually turn this into a question for you, Matt.
Uh-oh.
You live in New York City. You like to point out where people live, so I'm going to point out you live in New York City. New York City has one of the longest and deepest histories of any big city in the United States with rent control. There's a lot of rent control apartments in New York City, and if you've got one and it's nice, it can be pretty great. I have met a few people in my life who have just unbelievable deals on large old apartments, and they love rent control. But you, I don't think, live in a rent control apartment. And I would just ask you, do you think New York City is an inexpensive place to live?
Sorry. I know that through, let's say, personal associations, that there are still quite a few people in New York who live in, you know, fashionable neighborhoods like where Nick lives. Although mine's fashionable too. We just don't have much rent control here. Where you have a rent-controlled apartment, 3 bedrooms, Greenwich Village, something like that, and you're paying $500 a month. $500 a month. A place that would go for $7,000, $8,000 or something is as low as that. And I would point out, it's heritable or inheritable or whatever. It's hereditary. You can pass it down as a thing you don't own. You literally don't own it. You're paying rent. You can pass it down to your families or loved ones or caregiver. In the last, like, if the person has lived there for the last, I don't know, 12 to 18 months, something like that. And a lot of times it's like a 20-something caregiver that marries a 90-year-old and gets the asset. It is amazing to see the distortions in the market. And the city of New York and the state of New York have both passed recently, but especially in the city, incredible controls over what you can and cannot do to your property here. And it is already decimating all kinds of construction jobs and other things. There's landlords, of whom I know a couple, have just said, I'm never spending money again. I'm never spending money again, and I can't wait to sell this bad boy, or just like boot everyone out whenever I can, not that you can anymore, and shift it all to Airbnb. It is staggering how much it, and the whole political class, and Bill de Blasio, when he ran for election, this was like his main thing, like, we're going to get affordable housing here, make people do it, and all of any evident research shows how insane that all is.
And so what happens is that you end up creating a kind of quasi-property that exacerbates inequality, because you often have people who are quite well off that end up living in large rent-controlled apartments.
My mother-in-law.
By the way.
You've created a kind of government-granted property, and so that exacerbates inequality, and then at the same time, you're exacerbating it on the supply end, because if you are a developer in a rent control city like New York, where you have a fair amount of wealth, all you end up building is high-end luxury housing. And so what gets built is the small amount of mandatory affordable stuff that just sort of gets built out of, you know, because they have to. And then they have to make up their money by building a whole bunch of stuff that you can only afford to live in if you make seven figures a year.
According to Curbed, which is a website that covers New York, particularly housing issues, about 1% of New York apartments are under actual rent control, which is the type, the egregious form that Matt is talking about. About 50% or so, or 20%, are under rent stabilization, which is essentially what the Sanders law is. The Sanders law is bad for all of the reasons that have been discussed. To throw an extra one on that, it's not the role of the federal government to start dictating, you know, rent policies in Des Moines, Dubuque, and, Detroit. I mean, it's insane. And it's a
the three D's.
Yeah, those
of
were
American
terrible. I mean, I could have gone
control
with Dallas, Denver.
You did
and,
it. I'm so, proud of you for pulling out. I thought you weren't going to make it to Detroit.
I was going to go with whatever the Secretary of Energy, whose name escapes me right now, whatever he fluffed on. The former governor of Texas, Rick Perry.
Rick Perry.
Yeah, Rick Perry. No.
Del Rey,
Dallas, and Denver. You know, we could do this for a long time. The larger point is also, you know, there is a fix to this in New York and other places. In New York, LA, San Francisco, DC, they're always going to be more expensive than other places because people are willing to pay a premium to live there for all sorts of reasons. And this is something that I've talked about as the demand for living. When you talk about the cost of living, the demand for living. I lived in Huntsville, Texas, the site of Texas's death chamber. They could literally not give away houses, five-bedroom houses. They could not sell them for $80,000 an hour and 10 minutes from Houston because nobody fucking wanted to live there. There was no demand for living there, and there isn't going to be. You pay a premium to live in a city. You could make New York affordable in the same way that Tokyo made itself affordable, which is by building more housing and deregulating the building of housing, period. And if you care at all about fucking poor people and middle class people, as opposed to politically connected people, that's what Bernie Sanders should be championing. But he can't because he's an idiot who is stuck. I mean, when did he leave New York? Like in the early 70s, right? Or in the late 60s? He still thinks that rent control exists and that it's helping large swaths of people who have just come home from World War II. He's as out of it as Joe Biden or Trump is. I mean, he's living in the past, and it's not even a good past. The answer to this is to, you know, have cities finally, you know, roll with the YIMBY crowd and start building more housing. It's not to have Bernie Sanders dictate 3.5% is okay this year, but next year you're only going to get 1%.
Look,
I want to talk a little bit about corruption too, because that's the theme of this podcast, which is that when you try to keep the price of a scarce good artificially low, what immediately happens is that people figure out workarounds to use money to acquire that scarce good, even if you can't do it just by setting the retail price higher. Key money is a common practice in New York and other places that have rent control, which is essentially a bribe to your landlord, more or less. There's also, of course, discrimination by, you know, if you can't set the price, you can at least find tenants who will be in some other way preferable to you. That opens the door for all kinds of unconscious and conscious bias. It also creates a situation where there's going to be bribery, not just at the tenant-landlord level, but at the in the bureaucracy, that people will bribe officials to look the other way. And that in turn leads to a cascade of more regulation. So Bernie is currently selling this rent control plan as being simple. He says it's very straightforward and direct. It's the kind of thing everyone can understand and benefit from. But there will immediately be a cascade of regulations that will follow on its heels should it be put in place to prevent all of these behaviors from kicking in. And that's what we were talking about earlier with potential bans on background checks and all kinds of things like that. So just wanted to make another point, which is if you want people to lose faith in the system, and Nick doesn't, and I think I don't, though I'm not sure, a widespread rent control policy undermined by widespread corruption is a real good way.
Catherine, I think your position is that the system is bad, but we need people to have faith in it.
No, I mean, that's definitely Nick's position. I actually am genuinely torn based on Nick's, I think, very, very interesting writing about this. Like, I think the system is bad and people shouldn't have faith in it still. I'm pretty sure that that's the best way to do this. But Nick has convinced me that, in fact, people not having faith in it can have pretty serious negative consequences that do not improve the system, but instead make it easier.
I think it's also in the case of things like healthcare and housing in particular, and education too, also, where there is a functioning market and in general a flourishing market, like where, you know, the economic system isn't a bad thing. And what you do are for people who are priced out of the market or can't participate fully, subsidize them rather than controlling every transaction in the market. And you could do that with housing. You could offer housing assistance to people rather than saying there, nobody can charge more than this for rent, or nobody, you can't build freely and you have to put up a bunch of, you know, low income or middle income affordable housing units in everything you do, which in 15 minutes of going on the market, it changes hands and gets out of control. It's the same thing with healthcare. Instead of saying we need to regulate every aspect of the healthcare market, you know, you help the people who are priced out of the market for whatever reason. We do that with food. We don't make The government does not say, okay, no grocery store can charge more than X amount for whatever. You know, you give food stamps to the people who need help. And that doesn't even work particularly well. But this mania, and this is at the heart of Bernie Sanders, and I think to a large degree, Elizabeth Warren's conception of capitalism, and it's fucked up and it's bad, is that no, because the system doesn't work perfectly well for everybody, we have to control the entire system of transactions, as opposed to saying, we should make markets more efficient, have them work more freely through deregulation and through visible transactions and all of that. And then we help people, we subsidize people on the edges who are not participating properly. It's a much easier way to fix things, because then instead of being in charge of every goddamn transaction at every level, you're just helping people who are in obvious need.
Yeah, both Warren and Sanders want the government to play economic middleman in virtually every significant economic transaction.
Let's go to our end of show, What Are You Consuming? We're going to talk about the climate strike and the UN meeting here. Ran out of time, so I'm going to use mine to sort of cheat and talk about that a little bit, in that I consumed a piece in Friday's New York Times that for me was very unintentionally comical, I should say, about how certain progressives were very upset and teachers were upset, including, of course, in my district, because we have too many journalists who live here and they all squawk about the fact that it wasn't enough that 1.1 million school children in the public system in New York were basically given the day off if they wanted it, as long as they had a permission slip from their parents to go protest because they liked this protest. But they were mad that teachers weren't also allowed to serve as chaperones on this day off. And there's a little delicious sentence in there that I want to highlight, saying the decision to not allow teachers to go out as well as their students. The decision also underlines the difficulties in separating the politics of climate change from teaching about the science of it, even in liberal-leaning New York and in a school system that is viewed by some experts as a national leader in integrating climate issues into the classroom. This decision does not underline that difficulty. Here's what you do. You teach about climate science when you're in the class, and then you protest about climate science when you're out of the class. This seems easy enough to me, but we got 1,000 words out of that. Catherine, what did you consume since last time we talked?
I consumed a giant stack of magazines that Elizabeth Nolan Brown brought into the office, imported to Washington, D.C. from Ohio, a bunch of 17 magazines from the mid-90s. You guys, incredible stuff in there. Among other things, a quiz asking which celebrity you would like to be your teacher, which listed Bill Cosby as one of the options, as well as asking readers to handicap the likelihood of various couples staying together, where two of the couples were Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman and Whitney Houston and Bobby Brown. Incredible stuff. Really bad lipstick choices. Also, all of it is back. The 90s are here again. And if you have some vintage 17 magazines, now is the time to get in there and check it out. Mostly, also a reminder that even I am a lot more woke than I was when I was 17, I have discovered. Like, there is just like a lot of aggressive use of the word slut in those magazines that I am now like, wow, this doesn't seem like a great idea for teenage girls.
Was it sex positive, though? Was it girl power slut?
No, definitely not. No. Don't be a slut, Nick, is the real takeaway of 17 magazines in 1996.
I'm going to let that just hang. But Nick, before I go to you, just have to say that I'm continuing my quest in watching whatever you recommend 3 to 4 weeks later. So I just watched the Dylan doc and holy crap, those performances from 1975 or something else. What did you consume, Nick?
So for fun, I actually went back, kind of speaking to Catherine's point. I was watching some episodes of the Comedy Central, or actually, was it Adult Swim? I don't even remember now. Strangers with Candy, the show that was that starred. Oh, man, I'm sorry. I'm having a Joe Biden corn pop moment right now. Amy Sedaris. And it was partly created by her. And
largely starred Amy Sedaris.
And Stephen Colbert.
Partially.
Along with a couple of other people. And if you go back and look at that, this was on in the late 90s. It was billed as the after school or after hours after school special. And it's about a 40-something year old parolee who has to finish high school as a condition of her parole. And it is filthy and dirty. And the comedy, because people have been talking about guy who got bounced from Saturday Night Live without even showing up, as well as Dave Chappelle for trafficking in like off-color humor. Strangers with Candy is unthinkable in today's context, and it's still deeply and darkly funny, and I highly recommend that. I've also been reading How the Other Half Learns, Equality, Excellence, and the Battle Over School Choice by Robert Pondicio. I'm going to be interviewing him next week, along with Billy Bragg, the great post-punk folk rocker from England, whose book, The Three Dimensions of Freedom, is a left libertarian attack on much of what the reason universe holds dear. People like Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises are called out early on, Milton Friedman and whatnot. And part of his argument is that freedom doesn't mean anything if you don't have the ability to participate in society. And so it's a left libertarian critique. It's actually very individualistic. And I'm looking forward to both speaking with Pondicio and Bragg next week. But in the meantime, if you really want to experience a blast from the past, check out Strangers with Candy on Comedy Central's homepage or website.
Peter?
I saw Ad Astra, the new science fiction movie starring Brad Pitt. It is a Brad Pitt sad dad in space movie. And it kind of, sort of, works sometimes. I think the movie's kind of a mess. It is a beautiful, fascinating mess. It's very episodic. So there's all of these scenes that work really well on their own terms, but don't really have much meaning or pay off later in the film. In particular, about half an hour in, if you've seen the trailers, there is a fantastic sequence in which Brad Pitt he has stopped on the moon and kind of gone to an airport mall thing on the moon, and then he's being transported to a secret base on the moon. And of course they warn, well, there are moon pirates. So this warning happens, and then they get attacked. Obviously, the convoy gets attacked by moon pirates, and there's a big action sequence. It's just crackerjack, really stunningly made, and the moon pirates never show up again. They have no further role in the movie. They're never referenced again. There's no sort of indication that the moon pirates, like, made anything important in the film happened, except that Donald Sutherland, who had also appeared briefly, Donald Sutherland doesn't really survive this sequence. And also Donald Sutherland doesn't ever come back. And so it's this very odd movie that's like, on the one hand, wants to be very moody and contemplative, a lot like the George Clooney Solaris that Steven Soderbergh made 15 years ago or so. And then on the other hand, it wants to have these moments of kind of big action sequences. And then it wants to resolve in what my friend Sonny Bunch has said is basically an extended sci-fi version of the Fight Club sequence, in which they sit in the bathtub and talk about how they didn't really know their fathers, because the whole thing is structured as a quest for Brad Pitt to find his dad, who is played by Tommy Lee Jones, who's gone off to Neptune and is working on, is trying to find extraterrestrial life, but in doing so has set off some sort of pulse that might end with the total destruction of the solar system. It's beautiful. It's moody. It's really wonderfully made, and I don't think it's a good movie.
Peter, to tie it into...
You sold me on it.
To tie it into Catherine reading 17 magazine and the shopping mall, what is the Forever 21 and the Wet Seal like on the moon's shopping mall?
You don't see those, but you do see, as Brad Pitt is leaving...
Is there a Hot Topic?
There's this great... As the
Yeah, I was going to say, only Hot Topic survives.
As the moon
the
convoy is like leaving the mall airport situation, you see like a giant neon Nathan's Hot Dogs sign kind of affixed to the moon base.
The worst fast food.
Oh, dead.
But like, you know that...
Not at all.
You've been to the Nathan's in Penn Station. You have had those chicken nuggets.
I have.
You got to get the frog.
Oh, for two.
Get the frog legs
back.
at Nathan's.
Oh, for three.
They're better than you think.
That's our new tagline for this podcast. We're better than you think. Okay, that's all the frog pegs we have. How did that happen? Jesus.
Can I talk about Dr. Bellows?
We're doing so well.
Can I talk about
like
Dr. Bellows a little bit more and Gladys Kravitz from Bewitched?
Creatures. No. Jesus, people.
I have so many more thoughts about Swamp Thing.
What do you think about Man Thing, Peter?
We will hear about those
Swamp
next
things.
Week. Goodbye.